The 1999 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session 161, Toward a Messianic Postmodernism, Deconstruction and Religion, a paper by John D. Caputo.
Which is an attempt to formulate a postmodernist ethics. And all three of those books that I just mentioned are on sale in the book room. He's also written a couple of other, probably a number of other things, among which Demythologizing Heidegger, A Critical Reappraisal of Heidegger, Radical Hermeneutics, Repetition, Deconstruction and Hermeneutics Project, which revisits hermeneutics in the light of deconstruction. He is also the author of Heidegger and Aquinas, an essay on overcoming metaphysics, and the mystical elements of Heidegger's thoughts, and is the co-author of Modernity and Its Discontents. He's also co-edited a volume on Foucault entitled Foucault and the Critique of Institutions. He's the past executive director of the Society for Phenomenology and Existential Philosophy and the editor of the book series Perspectives on Continental Philosophy. He's the past president of the American Catholic Philosophical Association, a past member of the National Board of Officers of the American Philosophical Association, and the executive committee of the American Philosophical Association Eastern Division. He has held research fellowships from the National Endowment of the Humanities and from the American Council of Learned Societies. After Professor Caputo makes a presentation, there'll be time for questions and answers. We've asked that he repeat your question, so don't make him longer than 3 minutes. So we'll have those on tape. And this session will end at 5 o'clock. Now, please join me in welcoming Professor Caputo to Salt Lake City in the Sunstone Symposium.
Thank you very much, John, and I'm very happy and pleased to be here, and I'm thankful to the B.H. Roberts Society for the... It's very nice of you to invite an Italian Catholic from Philadelphia all the way out here to talk about deconstruction. Somebody said to me, say, what kind of an accent is that? It's Philadelphia. You did a very good job struggling with all those titles and words and strange jargon we use. I will try to... I will not read to you, I promise. I'm going to walk my way through this topic and try to talk about a movement that is not quite a movement and is... I think interesting to those of us who have a religious tradition. Although the man we're going to talk about, that I'm going to get to, Jacques Derrida, is an atheist. He is an interesting atheist. And he has some very provocative things to say to us. And he will make us think. And there is no better gift than that. And the only proper form of gratitude is to think back. So let's go. First of all, this word postmodernism means so much. It's overused. I think it's been ground into senselessness, really, from overuse. But it's with us. It's a word that we need to deal with. I use it in order to draw a crowd. You know, I don't use it in a technical sense because I would be slaughtered by my colleagues. What I'm going to do today is do what philosophers call give it a stipulative definition. That is going to say, let's say that it means this. And it sort of does. It's not bad. Let's say that postmodernism is a philosophy of difference. That is, it's a way of thinking about human life and about society and politics and ethics and everything, which makes the focal concept, the idea that's organizing things and also disorganizing them, difference, which differs from the way philosophers and theologians and everybody traditionally think, because we tend to organize things around the notion of unity. Okay? Well, and that's especially true of what is called modernity. So by modernity, we mean this thing that sort of reached a peak in the 17th and 18th century, where the notion of rationality had begun to sort of glow white hot. And we distinguished reason from faith, and we insisted upon rational structures which could be commonly accepted, universally understood by everyone. That's the very idea of rationality. So Enlightenment rationality stresses notions like universality, commonality, consensus. Okay. And all the way back to the Greeks. I mean, we tend to think like that. Postmoderns, therefore, are folks who have begun to worry about the, let's say, the hegemony of all this unity and community and universality and sameness, and struck up an argument on behalf of what's different. What's different? Now, within this philosophy of difference, I'm going to say there are two different trends. This is too simple, but it's a heuristic. On the one hand, those two trends of the philosophy of difference, and therefore those two versions, let's say these two versions of postmodernism, go back to two 19th century predecessor philosophers, thinkers, who these contemporary postmodernists are following. On the one hand, there's this version of postmodernism that goes back to Nietzsche. Looks like Nietzsche, but you don't say Nietzsche, you say Nietzsche. And he, of course, is the most famous. He made the cover of Time magazine many years ago for this God is Dead, the death of God, Nietzsche, the great philosopher of the death of God. On the other hand, the other predecessor figure is a Lutheran theologian by the name of Kierkegaard. And they had rather different ideas of what difference meant, differing ideas of difference, let's say. Now, I'm going to call the one Dionysian postmodernism. And that's the one that goes back to Nietzsche. And I'm going to call the other one Messianic postmodernism. And that's the one that goes back to Kierkegaard. Now, the word postmodernism and deconstruction in the work of Jacques Derrida is a form of postmodernism, if we're going to use this word. Postmodernists take a lot of heat. They get a lot of criticism. And the more you would know about certain things about postmodernism, the more you'd hate it. Because on one side of it, one face of it, let's say, it has, it sounds, it looks, it seems to be victim to a sort of string of illnesses that are have a kind of family resemblance. This is the sort of things that people say about it. This is relativism, subjectivism, skepticism, anarchism, antinomianism, anti-institutionalism, nihilism, despair. Like that. I mean, you get the drift. Now, what my argument, and this is sort of an artifice. It's a sort of good cop, bad cop strategy. My argument is going to be that most of the objections that are made against the postmodernists and against deconstruction have in mind this Nietzschean or Dionysian version of postmodernism. And they're not thinking about this other version that I'm calling messianic, that goes back to Kierkegaard, and whose representatives today are found in the work of a man named Levinas and the man of the hour this afternoon, Jacques Derrida. Surely, if all these objections against these people were valid, they would be of no use to anybody. A thinking that would fall into nihilism and despair and skepticism would be of no use to anyone. Now, in this good cop, bad cop strategy, I'm sort of letting Nietzsche take the hit for these objections. Now, in my heart, I don't actually believe that, and if I had still one more hour, if the Roberts Society could come up with still one more hour, I could give a pretty good defense of Nietzsche, too. But I'm going to let Nietzsche take a bullet for me today. So let's first of all take a look at the Nietzschean version. In this first version, this Nietzschean version of postmodernism, what the word difference means, I would say, in a single word, would be diversity. Heteros, in the sense of the multiple, the diverse, the different kinds, polymorphism, the multiplication of forms, as many different forms and kinds as possible. And that goes hand in hand with Nietzsche's idea of what he calls perspectivalism. Perspectivalism says that each of us not only has a certain perspective on the world, but that we are that perspective. That we are all the way down to our toes, all the way down. We are that perspective. We are a certain kind of organization of life and of what he would call force or power. A certain kind of constellation of forces, really, multiple forces, that have been sort of come together. We put the hat of a proper name on its head, and we say, George. But underneath that hat is this sort of seething, fomenting turmoil of multiple forces that have been organized in a certain way, which is that being's perspective on things. And he says it's not so much that some perspectives are true and some perspectives are false, but that there are stronger and weaker ones, healthy and sick ones, not true and false. He was critical of the idea of truth and falsity, of absolute truth, because which he said was represented the ascetic ideal. It represented this kind of discipline in which we lock or imprison or enchain our mind to some principle around which everything has to be organized. And he says, classically, that took the form of theology and of God. But it's not simply God. That place of the absolute center, which holds everything stable, could be filled by other things. If you were a physicist, a naturalistic, atheistic physicist, say, and I'm not saying the physicists are all the physicists are like that, I'm saying if you were all those things, then physics and the laws of physics and the laws of nature would occupy that kind of absolute center. And Nietzsche's notion was to break loose of that and to allow for the play of interpretation. And he wanted to say, all of our beliefs are interpretations. Physics, too, is an interpretation. And he wanted to unleash the play of interpretations. Even grammar, Indo-European grammar, is a prison that and a center which tries to make us think in a certain way. And we need to, he says, the death of God will not be complete until we are free even from grammar. If there were a God, he says, what would there be left for us to create? Every possibility would be realized, and we would have nothing to do except to be a copy, to be an imitation. The death of God, therefore, is the emancipation of the play of perspectives. Of force, of energy, of power, which surges up and takes now this form, now that. Some higher forms, some lower forms. Now, that way of thinking skirts very close to all these things we were just talking about relativism, for example, skepticism. All there would be instead of truth, it would be the multiple play of perspectives. Now, even so, that kind of thinking has had an interesting influence on certain forms of, let's say, postmodern theology. Because one of the things that it does is show you the way in which things have been constituted historically. Nietzsche was fond of what he called a genealogy, showing the way in which things haven't dropped out of heaven into our lap, but they have been historically constituted. They were built up in certain ways, and they hold together more or less tenuously. So there's something deeply historicizing about Nietzsche's way of thinking. And, for example, feminist theologians have found it very useful to show the way in which certain power structures in the institutional church have a genesis, have a story. And it's a very frightening thing to find that something has a history, has a story, that it was generated, built up in a certain way. It didn't fall from heaven. My mother still believes that the rosary was Jesus who made up the rosary. Didn't have. If you point to its historical point of origin, it was scandalous. History is scandalous. Now, on the whole, this version of postmodernism has been greeted with a certain amount of hostility. Hostility, first of all, from conservatism, because the conservatives hate it. But it's also been met with a certain amount of hostility from what you might call the old left, that is, the classical liberal left, because the classical liberal left is modernist. It's an Enlightenment left. It goes back to the classical ideas of rationality. And so the old left is sharply critical of Nietzsche as a relativist, whereas freedom and equality and democracy depend upon rationality, not this kind of relativism. So he gets hit by the conservative left, right, and by the old left. He has himself been adopted or baptized, it's not the right word, he's been appropriated by what you might call a Nietzscheanized left, because this sort of thing can be used for feminist theory, for gay and liberal, gay and lesbian theory. It's got a lot of very interesting applications, all which Nietzsche himself would hate, because Nietzsche was himself a very reactionary thinker in many ways, politically. But no matter what, without getting drawn any further into a debate about Nietzsche and that version of postmodernism, which has generally been thought to be very hostile to Christianity, I'm not going to base my case on that. I'm going to say, It does get us into a certain amount of trouble, we people who talk about deconstruction and Foucault and Derrida, etc. At its very best, it is a very productive way of thinking. At its worst, it really does give everybody the impression that anything goes. Anything goes. You think what you think, I think what I think, anything goes. There are no standards of rationality. The idea of rationality is a fiction. It was invented in the 18th century. So at its worst, it's trouble. And I do think that when people criticize it, criticize postmodernism, deconstructionism, etc., that's what they're thinking about. Now, what I want to say is, but look, wait a minute. Apart from how we would finally adjudicate that case, look, there's another form of postmodernism. And that's what I want to turn to now. And it goes back to not Nietzsche, but Kierkegaard, who was a very unhappy Lutheran theologian who should have married his girlfriend. Of course, if he had married his girlfriend, he would have never written all those wonderful books. Because every book that he wrote was a lament about why he didn't marry Regina. After a while, you get sick of hearing it, and you say, why didn't you just marry her? But then we wouldn't have all the concept of anxiety and the sickness unto death and all these other cheery books that he wrote. He's very Lutheran, very guilt-ridden, and very funny, a comic writer. Actually, both of these figures, both Nietzsche and Kierkegaard, are comic writers. Tragic comedy, or laughing through their tears. In this version of postmodernism, which goes back to Kierkegaard, comes forward in Levinas and Derrida, the word difference doesn't mean this proliferation of polymorphic diversity and the multiplication of forms. It doesn't mean that. It means alterity, otherness. Not diversity, but otherness. In the sense of the Latin alter, which means that one over there. That singular one, there, over there, who confronts me, who you could say, shatters the circle of sameness that I build around myself. We live in our own world. We live in what Levinas calls the world of the same. Everything is me or mine. And for me to understand something is to make it mine. And Levinas says, well, try to think some other way. Try to think in terms of something which shatters my sameness. The other. Now, that goes back in the philosophical tradition. There's a tradition for thinking like that. And it's the religious tradition that thinks like that. Because it's going back to the classical philosophical idea of transcendence. Something overwhelming, transcendent. It goes back to Plato, actually, and Plato's idea of the good, where the good is, he says, beyond being. It's not only, it's the source of being, it's the source of knowledge, but it's beyond knowledge, beyond being, beyond the beyond. Ultra, ne plus ultra. And it goes back to the biblical tradition, where God, and that's what Kierkegaard and Levinas have in mind, is the Most High, the Eminent One, the One who comes from on high, the Ancient of Days. Kierkegaard and Levinas and Derrida all come back to the same expression in describing this alterity. And that is the expression, wholly other. Holy other. Now, the holy other, strictly speaking, if you gave it a rigorous philosophical analysis, the idea would be incoherent. Because if something were utterly and wholly other, then you wouldn't have any idea what you're talking about at all. It would make no sense. So the holy other has to be relative to something, which means it can't be wholly other. The absolutely other has to be relative to something. Otherwise, you can't be surprised unless you have a horizon of expectation. Right? So the absolute surprise, the holy other, needs to shatter some sphere of expectation. So that's what it that's, I think, what the expression means, holy other. It means unforeseeable, unimaginable. Something comes along and just blows away the horizon of possibility and of expectation that we're operating with. We move around the world with a set of presuppositions about what's possible, what's not possible, and then every once in a while something comes along and upsets that. And the Thomas Kuhn, the Structure of Scientific Revolutions, talked about something like that even in the history of science. When somebody just simply comes up with something that the existing horizon didn't think you could come up with. And that's true because they completely reconfigured the horizon. It's like avant-garde art. Avant-garde art is not avant-garde. Avant-garde art is art that leaves you walking out of the gallery saying, but is it art? Well, if you weren't asking that, it wouldn't be avant-garde. Because if you didn't ask that question, if you already knew it was art, that would mean you'd have a horizon of expectation for it. There'd be a community of taste formed around it. There'd be judgments, ways to other examples of it, ways to judge it. Avant-garde art comes along and does something that shatters all of that. And then it either blows away because it's ridiculous, or it forges a new community around itself. And then it's not avant-garde anymore. Now it becomes part of the history. Well, the holy other is like that. It's something that shatters what we thought possible and what we expected. Now, one very interesting form of the notion of the holy other is what some philosophers had to say about God. Like what St. Anselm said. That in which no greater can be conceived. Think of something. God's greater than that. Think of something greater than that. God's greater than that. God is excess. God, the notion of a concept like that in which no greater can be conceived, is a concept that has built into itself the exceeding of anything that you can think about. And that's what you mean. What I mean is something that I couldn't possibly mean. That's what God is. Because if I meant it, if I saw it, if I understood it, that's not God. God is greater than that. Descartes said that God is an infinite idea. He says, I have an idea in my mind. It's the idea of an infinite being. I can't understand it. I have an idea in my mind that I can't understand. Therefore, I can't be the author of the idea. It must have come from God. The idea of something of uncontainable plenitude. So that at any point that you try to contain it in a concept, because that's what a concept means, to conceive, to hold, to grasp around. Anytime you try to do that, you missed it. If you conceived it, you missed it. So what you need is a concept of the inconceivable. You need a concept whose formal structure signifies the inconceivability of what you're talking about. Which is what Anselm's concept does. His quasi-concept. It's like a shore that I set out to reach, but I never reach. I'm going there, but I never get there. I have a relationship to it. Because you don't want to say you have no relationship to this, or it becomes meaningless. I have a relationship to it, but I never get there. There's a French writer named Blanchot used a play on words. He said, le pas au-delà. Pas meaning no, and pas meaning step. So, le pas au-delà, the step beyond, and le pas au-delà, no beyond, the no beyond. So the no step beyond. It's the step I'm always taking, but never making. It's the shore I never reach. It's a relationship, the Levinas says, it's a matter of having a relationship with something which in which the terms of the relationship tend to withdraw from the relationship. So as a relation without relation. Because it's in a certain sense a relation of absolutes. An absolute is something that has no relation. So I have a relation with something which tends to withdraw from that relation. Like trying to, and this is actually not just an example, it's a very important instance, the other person's mind. Other person's mind is something I will never know. You say you're in pain, I know what you mean. But I don't know your pain. Because if I knew your pain, I'd be you. I can see your eyes, but I can't see your eyes seeing. I can know that who you are, but I can't know you. I can't experience your experiences, because the very definition of being you is that you're the one having those experiences. If I could have those experiences, I would be you. So the other person is someone structurally other. I have to define the other person in such a way that I can never be there, get there. It's the shore I can't reach. So it's a little bit like God. There's something structural about my not getting there. Now, if we look at the Nietzschean version of postmodernism, you could say what Nietzsche was interested in was heteromorphic diversity. Well, this version, which is coming from Kierkegaard through Levinas and Derrida, is not interested in heteromorphism exactly, but let's say heteronomism, heteronomy, which means literally the rule of the other one. That is, this is a way of thinking in which the other has a certain kind of primacy. The other overtakes me, interrupts my sameness, and lays claim to me, seeks me out, solicits me, calls me, invokes me. And my answer is, here I am. And of course, I'm now quoting Genesis, right? Abraham, here I am. Hine nai. Me voici. See me here. The other calls, here I am. There's a certain rule of the other. Whereas in the other version of postmodernism, the rule is of the same, I think. I mean, there's a certain sense in which it's the rule of the same, with all of its love of diversity. There's even a kind of biblical creationist model behind this version of postmodernism, because it's like the idea of creation. Levinas, it's a very beautiful expression. He says, creation means to answer a call that you never heard. To answer a call that you never heard. Absolute heteronomy. Right? Utter dependence in being. Now, what's interesting to me is that this very biblical and religious version of postmodernism has made its way into Jacques Derrida, who you would have never guessed would have gotten into it. Why? Well, for one thing, he's an atheist, and it's a very religious paradigm. And for another thing, for a long time, people associated Derrida with the first version of postmodernism, with the Nietzschean version of postmodernism. But there were those of us who were arguing that that was a mistake. As a matter of fact, I think both of these things are present in Derrida, and a certain amount is part of the problem. Derrida is deeply interested in this structure of the other, the Holy Other, who calls me, lays claim to me, and I respond. He's interested in that without reference to religion as an institutional dogma. He's interested in it, in its structure, without getting caught up in the dogmas of any particular religion. The particular religions he calls the messianisms, Christian, Islamic, Judaic, messianisms, the religions of the book. And from that, he ferrets out this structure, this formal structure, called the messianic. Which is what he calls religion without religion. Religion without the hierarchy telling you what you're allowed to talk about. Actually sounds interesting. For both Catholics and Mormons, from what I can tell from listening to some of these discussions today. So the curious thing is that Derrida has begun to speak about and deconstruction, which is really one of the bad boys. Deconstruction is bad, you know. It's Michael Jackson bad, you know. It's not good. It gets into trouble. It makes trouble. It multiplies interpretations. It seems to cause confusion. It's bad. Well, turns out it's actually got this biblical dimension to it. In 1990, Derrida published a book. It was actually co-authored with another book. It was a book. There's a book at the top of the page, and then there was this book at the bottom of the page, and Derrida was writing the book at the bottom of the page. And at the top of the page, each page was divided in half. Top of the page was somebody writing about Derrida. And then Derrida was writing down at the bottom, and the idea was he was going to write something that the guy writing the book on the top of the page would never be able to tell was going to happen. He was going to surprise him with something wholly other. So the book was a bet. And what he did was, he won the bet by cheating, because what he did was write something very autobiographical, which the guy writing the book on the top of the page couldn't possibly have ever known. Very private, subjective secrets of his family and childhood, etc. But what was interesting was that he modeled the book after the Confessions of St. Augustine. And he called the book Cire Confession, English translation Circumfession. So circumcision, confession. And he writes of his youth in Algeria. He grows up in Algeria as a Jewish kid in Algeria who speaks French, pied noir. So he's interested in difference. You know, he was a Blackfoot. He was a French-speaking Jew in colonial Algeria, in an Arab world. Okay, so there's a lot of heteromorphic diversity there. And he talks about his alliance with Judaism, which he grew up in, but he sort of, you know, he played hooky from Hebrew school. He didn't take it very seriously. What he knows about it, he knows by assimilation rather than study. And he's writing about the death of his mother, Georgette, who is dying in Nice on the other side of the Mediterranean, just the way Monica died in Ostia on the other side of the Mediterranean, because it turns out St. Augustine, Hippo, was born in Hippo. Hippo is part of modern-day Algeria. And so, and Derrida was raised on a street called the Rue Saint-Augustin. And it was all this Augustinian, Augustine was part of the culture. He says, I speak Christian Latin French. Christian language. He said they didn't even speak of circumcision. They spoke of baptism. Didn't speak of bar mitzvah. They spoke of confirmation. Completely assimilated into this Christian culture. So, and he writes about how he's the son of these tears. You know, Filius Estarum Lacrimarum, this magnificent, this beautiful book of St. Augustine. He's crying all the time. He's praying all the time. And Monica is crying over him, worrying about him, and she refers to him as the son of these tears. He refers to himself as the son of these tears. And Derrida says, he was a weepy kid. And his mother was very worried about him, and she thought, and she was always asking his friends whether he still believed in God. And she would never ask him. And he says, she must have known that the constancy of God in my life is called by other names, even though I rightly pass for an atheist. Now, what I argue at some length in a book called The Prayers and Tears of Jacques Derrida, and then in this book here it's much more abbreviated, is that deconstruction needs to be thought of in terms of this this praying and weeping of this sort of Jewish Augustinian atheist. And it's a little bit like negative theology, and it's a little bit like not like negative theology. Negative theology is this tradition of saying we could never name God. The God that you can name is not the true God. God is unnameable, beyond every name. And Meister Eckhart said, I pray God to rid me of God. Beautiful. I pray God to rid me of God. Was Meister Eckhart an atheist? Nah. The church went after him for saying that, but they, you know, they do that. That's what hierarchies are paid for. They go after people who talk funny. When Meister Eckhart was called on the carpet about that, he said, look, I'm not saying there is no God. Well, I want to be rid of God. I'm saying I want to be rid of any idol, any concept of God, anything less than God. I want the God beyond God. I'm not denying anything. I'm affirming God even higher. Now, Derrida is very interested in that, in negative theology, because it's such a magnificent form of discourse. It's a form of speaking which tries to erase its own talk, tries to efface itself. Self-effacing words. A magnificently impossible, beautiful gesture. Derrida loves it. But he says there is a difference between what he's doing and what the negative theologian is doing, and that's because the negative theologian always ultimately knows what he's up to. Which, and because when the ecclesiastical apparatchiks come after him, he always says, look, I confess the common faith. I'm just trying to exalt God even more highly. Whereas Derrida will say, I don't know. I don't know who I am. I don't know who the Holy Other is. The negative theologian has a faith in who the Holy Other is. Derrida does not. But he loves the structure of prayer and of weeping for the Holy Other. And he takes this line from St. Augustine, from the Confessions, in which Augustine says, quid ergo amo cum Deum meum amo? What do I love when I love my God? And he looks to the natural world and the creatures, and they say, we are not he, ipse facit nos, he made us. We're not the ones you're looking for. Keep looking. And then his mind sends to God. But Derrida asks, to say it's God, it is God. God's the name of the desire. But what is God? Who is God? What do I love when I love God? I don't know. Now, in fact, Derrida will translate this, love. And when he does, or he'll talk about it in other ways. When he does, he'll say, the word that he'll tend most frequently to use is justice. Justice. And then you start thinking, this religion without religion reminds me of something I've read before in the prophets, in Amos. And Amos has the Most High say, I don't want your festivals. I don't want your sacrifices. I don't want your burnt offerings. I don't want your songs. I want justice to flow like water over the land. What deconstruction comes down to, in a nutshell, is this messianic call for justice, for the holy other, for the one who is to come, who will always be to come. He tells the story of Blanchot tells a story, an old rabbinic story, one commentary on the Messiah among the sages, is that the Messiah is never actually going to show up. The very structure of the Messiah is to be the one to come. Because after all, suppose he ever showed up. We would have to throw the tools on the truck. It would be all over. We would, history would end. The early Christians thought he was about to come, and they wrote to Paul, and they said, when's he coming? And Paul said, mind your own business. Don't worry about when he's coming. Put away your calendars and prepare yourself. Change your heart. Don't worry about the days and the season. Be ready. That's the structure of the Messiah, always to come. And so Blanchot tells the story from the sages where the Messiah actually appears incognito in the outskirts of the city of Rome. And someone penetrates the disguise and sees him and recognizes the Messiah. And he goes up to him and he says, when will you come? And Blanchot says, that is because you must make a distinction between presence and coming. Whatever is present is not the justice to come. The very idea of the justice to come is that it is still outstanding, still making demands upon us. We can never relax and say, it's here. So, we said, well, what do you call that deconstruction for? Well, the word deconstruction, which means to somehow or another loosen up or take apart, actually means, it is what it literally means to take apart, to abbild in German. It means to loosen a thing and make it pliable and flexible so that it's always open for what's coming, for what it doesn't see coming. So Derrida will distinguish justice from law. The law has a kind of rigidity and fixity to it, even though it needs applications. Justice is what the law can never see coming, or can only imperfectly see coming. Justice has to do with the singular ones whom the law misses. So the laws have to be revisable, repealable, redrawable. They have to be deconstructible in the name of what is undeconstructible. And so once a structure hardens, it is dead. Once it forms over, once it doesn't allow itself to be self-transforming, it's dead. So deconstruction doesn't mean to ruin something. It means to make it pliable, to find within it, not by imposing something from without, but to find within its own texts and traditions and practices and beliefs and ancient stories, to find openings for differences. Things that the reigning hegemonic authority wants to silence, exclude, marginalize, outlaw, excommunicate. Deconstruction says, if you write a fine enough history, you'll find different voices. You'll find a kind of turmoil and dissenting movement in the structure. And open the structure up to that. Let it loose. Let it open Open it up. Deconstruction means to open something. To what? To what's coming. What's coming? Don't know. The holy other is what I don't know. I have to be open to it. Might it be the devil? Might it be a monster? I don't know. It's a risk. And so he says, he's got a theory of community. He says a community should be without community. Community without community. What's that mean? Community is a community that opens itself up to risk and practices hospitality, which is the most ancient of the biblical virtues, right? Nomadic people, if you're going to go somewhere, you've got to expect hospitality on the other end. Another deconstructive virtue. Hospitality. What's hospitality mean? Openness to the other. What does community mean? One of its derivations is a fort, is a community. It's communere. It's the same word as munitions. It means to build a common defense around yourself against the other. So Derrida says, well, then we want a community without community. Community is open to the other, which is open to the future, which is open to justice, for the ones that are left out. And so there's even, and we, he says, we pray and we weep for this justice to come. And he said, well, what is Derrida's prayer? He does have a prayer. The prayer is, come, which is the end of the apocalypse, right, of John's revelation. Come. I mean, even in Christianity, look how profound the structure of the come is. Come. Even in Christianity, where Jesus has already come, the Messiah has already come. Well, what do we want? We want him to come again. Because that's the structure of history and the future. It's the coming. I don't know what, but come, the come. And so Derrida's prayer is like the end of John's revelation, Book of Revelation. Bien, he says, come. Oui, oui. Okay. Yes. Yes, yes. Because you can't just say yes once. And he says, when you say yes, well, we don't know if you've said yes. When you get married and you say, do you take this man? Do you take this woman? You say, I do. Well, we don't know if you do. We'll find out if you do. If you say yes today and tomorrow and the next day and every day, we'll find out whether you do. And so he says, you never say yes. Never one yes. Always two yeses. It's the structure of repetition. Yes, yes. So what is deconstruction? Bien. Oui, oui.
Due to the time and also because we have to reconfigure this room, we're going to